Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Fortune's Wheel, a podcast history of the late Middle Ages, and I'm Jonathan. On the last episode, we left off with news sent by Sigelgaita to Rome relating the recent happenings in Apulia. Norman nobles have already gathered and elected Sigelgaita's son as Duke Robert Guiscard's heir, as the Duke was gravely ill and assuredly dying. The news arrived within days of another death, this one in Rome, not Bari. Before we jump directly into our narrative in 1073, though, we need to finally, at long last, come to a full understanding about who the most influential power broker in the mid 11th century really was. We've heard his name before in the podcast, many times, in fact, but let's take some time to really see him in his entirety, or at least as close as we can come to it in podcast format. And concurrently, we will learn about the early life of a woman who would play such a big role in this man's later life, up to and including, possibly, her own bed. This is episode 121, entitled The Firebrand and the Reluctant Bride. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show. News relating Duke Robert Guiscard's death reached Rome in late April 1073. However, days earlier, on April 21st, 1073, Pope Alexander II died, and Rome was in an absolute tizzy trying to figure out who the cardinals would elect next. The population had a clear frontrunner, and the bishops and other clergy were in agreement as to who this person should be. You'll always have detractors wherever you go, but overwhelmingly, this man was set to be elected as the next pope. News of the mighty Duke Robert's death was enough to rock the boat fully, however. Pope Alexander II's papacy, all 12 years of it, which is pretty impressive for the time, was a romping great time for Normans around Europe. In the south, Robert Guiscard kicked out the Eastern Roman Empire from the Italian peninsula once and for all. Richard of Capua, he began his little conquest in Campania, the region just south of Rome, taking over not only minor Norman noblemen's domains, but also Lombard strongholds as well. Roger de Hauteville, well, we've heard plenty so far about his ongoing conquest of Muslim Sicily. Heck, we can even throw in how the ruffian Russell de Bayeul went way out east, served under the Byzantine emperor at Manzikert, and what we haven't gotten to yet, spoiler alert, was how he went on to capitalize on the instability across Anatolia and create his own little Norman statelet out near Armenia for a spell. And of course, in the north, we've seen Duke William of Normandy straight up conquer an already established kingdom in England. I'd venture to say that there was only one other rival to the Normans in terms of scope of influence and conquest during the 11th century. But even the Seljuk Turks fell woefully short of the Normans in that regard. And who oversaw much of this? Who was it? Pope Alexander II. And now he was dead. But was it really Alexander who orchestrated all those pieces? On this episode, we're going to finally put all the little snippets of the real power broker's life together. His name, if you'll recall, was Hildebrand. And yes, it should sound familiar to you. Hildebrand was a Lombard man born in Tuscany back around the year 1015, around the same time that Normans were beginning to be reported visiting southern Italy. So these Frenchmen, without question, passed through Hildebrand's world on their way south. Fun fact, John Julius Norwich, in his book The Other Conquest, says, quote, Hildebrand, or Hildeprand, was a common Lombard name, His father's name, Bonizzo, is an abbreviation of Bonaparte, which 7 centuries later we find again in the form of Buonaparte. Napoleon, Bonaparte, was also of Lombard stock. He and Hildebrand had much in common. End quote. And it's also worth pointing out, since we're talking about names here, that Hildebrand translated from Lombard to English means firebrand, which will go on to explain the type of mark he would leave on not only papal history, but medieval history as a whole. Still, it's interesting that an 11th century man called Firebrand would not only live up to the moniker, but also possibly be related way down the line to one of history's most feared and studied conquerors. As I said, Hildebrand has been mentioned on the podcast before, but I thought it would be beneficial for us to actually stop and focus on his story just for an episode. We know he was born around 1015 in Tuscany, and I'll add that his father was a lowly blacksmith. And how can a man of such humble origins grow up to become one of the most respected, and disrespected, I should add, and feared and remembered men to come out of the entire Middle Ages? At an early age, Hildebrand was sent to Rome to study at St. Mary on the Aventine. While there, he studied under a powerful abbot from Amalfi, as well as the future Pope Gregory VI, his uncle, as it turns out. This was the man Hildebrand would follow into exile in Germany, by the way, in the year 1048, and, after Gregory VI's death, would be traveling back to Rome to install a new pope when news came that one was sneakily installed in his absence. You'll notice from this, and what we'll soon learn here, that much of Hildebrand's story is directly defined by the tug of war between the church and the German crown. Everything that he earns, everything he achieves, everything that is taken from him, everything in his life can be traced back to this tug of war between church and state. After 1048, Hildebrand studied at the famous monastery at Cluny, the site of major monastic reform throughout the 11th century. The reforms that would come out of Cluny have already and will continue to fundamentally change the medieval church going forward, and Hildebrand was right in the thick of it all for a spell. At Cluny, the star pupil he was, he befriended the abbot there. The abbot's name was Bruno of Toul, who had his own reputation already as being one of the brightest and sharpest minds throughout Christendom, not to mention one of the truly holiest men out there, at least by reputation. After the death of Pope Damasus in 1048, Hildebrand was asked to accompany Abbot Bruno of Cluny to Rome, where Holy Roman Emperor Henry III wished to install him as Pope Leo IX. Bruno was the man who walked barefoot through the Roman streets to the Lateran Palace in order to show his devotion to being a humble servant of the church and to God. And Hildebrand walked beside Bruno for this act of subservience to the faith, to the church, to Rome, and of course to God. Alongside one of the most memorable and powerful popes in history, barefoot and in beggar's robes, this is how Hildebrand returned to Rome, where he would call home for the rest of his days. There in late 1048, Bruno did, in fact, be named Pope Leo IX. Hildebrand, as Leo's most valued confidant, was immediately elevated to the rank of deacon. Hildebrand was just 33 years old, which draws some parallels to how Jesus entered the city of Jerusalem that fateful week a millennium before. In 1053, Hildebrand found himself in the city of Civitate in eastern Italy with his friend Leo IX. Well, we know what Humphrey de Hauteville, accompanied by his little brother Robert Guiscard, did to the papal forces there, but there's no indication that Hildebrand was taken prisoner like Leo was. However, this is the first time we see him in a military role, which I think is notable. Also in 1053, there's a little offshoot that I'm currently working on that pursues some of the philosophical shifts that are also occurring throughout this century, and this one calls Hildebrand to be a papal legate to the city of Tours in France, a cultural and religious hub for the region, for centuries before and will be for centuries afterward as well. He was sent there to settle what might seem to us today to be a strange and quaint argument, but it had a fundamental impact on how Christians even today interpret the Bible. This dispute was begun by Bishop Berengar of Tours, who took serious issue with a priest named Anselm's interpretation of the Eucharist. Yes, for my awesome UK listeners, this is the same Anselm who would one day become the great Saint Anselm of Canterbury in just a few decades from this dispute. Same guy. So here we see Hildebrand serving as a primary papal ambassador deputized to settle a deeply philosophical interpretation of the holiest book in the entire religion, which showcases, by his mid-30s, Hildebrand was indeed a serious mind. His bestie, Leo IX, died just as the Great Schism of 1054 occurred, though if you remember, news of it failed to reach Leo in time. He had no idea by the time of his death of what had occurred in Constantinople. It's such a cool scene in our medieval narrative, if you remember from many, many episodes ago. Another firebrand named Frederick of Lorraine, a papal legate chosen by Leo to deliver an ultimatum to the archbishop named Michael Cerularius of Constantinople. And when Cerularius denied the ultimatum, this Frederick slammed open the doors of the Hagia Sophia during Mass and slammed in a papal bull on the altar itself in front of the huge crowd in attendance, including, obviously, Cerularius. The papal bull was an official excommunication of the Archbishop of Constantinople. Bam. How has that actually not made it into a movie or a Netflix show yet? It's a huge, huge part of history. Anyway, as Frederick is slamming the papal bull on the altar of the Hagia Sophia, Leo lay dying back in Italy, and Hildebrand was busy in France settling a dispute over the very soul of the Eucharist between two mighty medieval minds in Anselm and Berengar. That was 1054 for you. From here, Hildebrand served as close counsel under both Victor II and Stephen IX. Now, the whole thing with Pope Stephen IX was pretty interesting, especially from Hildebrand's perspective. Hildebrand was in Florence at this point in northern Italy, a name we've mentioned in passing but haven't focused on until this episode is one that will come into play here. Well, I mean, honestly, our Patreon members will recall a supporting listeners episode recently about this lady's father, the mighty Duke Bonifacio of Tuscany, so they got their first glimpses of her already. But young Matilda of Canossa, also known as Matilda of Tuscany or Matilda of Mantua, in her future years. Well, she was also present in Florence while Hildebrand was there at this time. Matilda's stepfather at this point, Duke Godfrey of Tuscany, also known as Duke Godfrey II of Lorraine, was trying desperately to do some power brokering of his own. And who better to do it with than the Pope? Well, there's one person, and everyone knew who it was by this time, though they never said it out loud. You don't say that part out loud. If Godfrey wanted something done, he should cozy up to Deacon Hildebrand. So in the growing Tuscan city of Florence on March 29th, 1058, we see Pope Stephen IX, Deacon Hildebrand, Duke Godfrey of Tuscany, his wife Beatrice, and his stepdaughter Matilda, and that same Frederick of Lorraine who slammed the papal bull on the altar of the Hagia Sophia 4 years earlier, these people were all present on that day in Florence in late March of 1058. Why? What was the occasion? Well, we don't know exactly, precisely, and we probably never will, but we know about March 29th, 1058. We know that it boils down to rumors and the death of one of these people. The rumors centered around Pope Stephen IX declaring a new Holy Roman Emperor. That's a big deal. This new emperor, interestingly, wasn't named Henry IV, the only real claimant to the throne at this point. See, Henry IV wasn't present, and he had still not even reached his majority yet. He was very young. and his mom was still ruling the German kingdom at the time in his stead. So who then? Who was going to become the Holy Roman Emperor if not for Henry IV? Rumors suggested that Stephen IX was ready to crown Frederick of Lorraine the Holy Roman Emperor. Now wait, what? What kind of claim would Frederick of Lorraine, an extremely hot-headed papal legate who caused a massive chasm between the Eastern and Western churches, what claim would he possibly have on the Holy Roman crown? I mean, technically, it's always been a German king who's been a Holy Roman emperor. Well, on the surface, it makes no sense. However, dig just an inch deeper, and we see an interesting connection. What if I told you that Duke Godfrey of Tuscany was actually, before marrying the widow Beatrice, the wife of Duke Bonifacio of Tuscany, what if he was just simply known as Godfrey of Lorraine? And Lorraine, by the way, way up north in the German kingdom, had long held claim on the German throne. Yeah, it's a lot, I know, believe me, and I'm trying to make it clear enough here, so let's just put it all together. Godfrey was the brother of Frederick. Godfrey was a powerful duke now in northern Italy. Frederick was well known in the church as well, for obvious reasons. But Frederick represented not only a bridge between the ecclesiastical and the secular political worlds, but he also embodied a physical claim on the crown of Germany itself. So, the rumors of Pope Stephen IX in Florence to crown Frederick of Lorraine the new Holy Roman Emperor, well, it's not as far-fetched as it first seemed. Take a moment to think about the seismic shift in history that would have caused had it actually happened. Really, instead of the power of the Holy Roman Empire staying centered on Germany itself, sure, Lorraine was farther north still, but Frederick was a mainstay down south in Italy. And with his brother as the Duke of Tuscany, it's quite conceivable that the epicenter of power in Europe would have shifted hundreds of miles south almost immediately and would stay there, presumably for the next several hundred years. It's fascinating to think about how different things would have been had Pope Stephen IX not died before he crowned Frederick Emperor. Yeah, on March 29th, 1058, with all of them in attendance in Florence, Stephen died. Assassination? Who knows? What we do know is that when the sun rose on March 30th, the world had no pope. Matilda, keep in mind, was there for it all, always watching, always listening, always taking mental notes and observing how important people spoke to each other and how they negotiated with each other. This experience would serve her well beyond words in her future, because she will, mark my words now, she will become a juggernaut of late 11th century politics. As for Hildebrand, he had to contend with an illiterate Roman priest becoming Benedict X before anyone knew what had happened. This, of course, was the work of Queen Regent Agnes up in Germany, and it was a smart move, to say the least. If those rumors were true, then Benedict X, her choice for pope, would buy more time for her son to grow up. But she underestimated her opponents, namely an opponent named Hildebrand. Now, while in Florence, within months of Stephen's death, Godfrey was at it again with Hildebrand. Another thing to note about Hildebrand was that he wasn't just well-connected in the church. He was also the nephew of Rome's wealthiest man, a man named Pierre Leoni. If Godfrey could get in with Hildebrand, then he would be in with Pierre Leoni down in Rome, which would be a boon in and of itself. All of them in Florence for the next several months, they all joined in negotiations for a papal opposition. They settled on Godfrey's own trusted Bishop Gerard of Florence. And with Pierre Leoni's help down in Rome, with the social and economic and even military power brokers there, on January 24th, 1059, just 9 months or so after Stephen's death, Bishop Gerard of Florence became Pope Nicholas II. Due to the lack of Roman support, the German-backed Benedict X was booted, though he still claimed the funny hat as his sole property. The disposal of Benedict X was something of note as well. Duke Godfrey of Tuscany rode at the head of a small army of Tuscan soldiers. Alongside him was Pope Nicholas II and Hildebrand. Once in Rome, Benedict fled. But fleeing to another location was not acceptable. For Nicholas to rule, he needed no opposition. Hildebrand immediately set out further south to the county of Aversa, to Capua, to meet up with the somewhat powerful Norman knight, Richard of Capua, or, as he's also known now, Richard of Aversa, who needed very little persuading to lend the Pope 300 of his own Norman knights in order to establish full dominance over Benedict X. To no one's surprise, Benedict gave in right away. Now, by the time of Nicholas II, Hildebrand was almost as high as he could be without wearing the funny hat. His rank was still deacon, but a deacon, though still not a priest, mind you, could hold serious sway in the grand scheme of papal politics. And, just so we can place it all in the proper religious context, under Stephen IX, Roman bishops were required to conduct Mass in St. Peter's Basilica each and every Sunday on a rotation, which held them to Rome for most of the year, barring any official papal excuses from their service. This sought to create a strong body of bishops inside their own little Vatican cocoon of sorts. To extend this, the term cardinal became more official under Stephen IX. Cardinal simply means primary, in essence. It may make more sense to know that cardo is the Latin word for hinge. So everything hinges on these power brokers, these cardinals. The first level of clergy to get the name cardinal was the deacon. At this time, Hildebrand, again, was a deacon, so his own prestige was slightly elevated already under Stephen IX. His official role, and we know this because of the existing papal bull signed January 18th of 1059, in the presence of this young Matilda, by the way, she was there for this big moment in Hildebrand's life. Hildebrand's title went from deacon to what was then called archdeacon, and he was given sole power of the Catholic Church's purse. Michelle K. Spike, in her book Tuscan Countess about Matilda of Canossa, she calls it a quid pro quo for all of Hildebrand's work on getting Nicholas into the papacy. It's arguable, sure, but I'd venture to say that Hildebrand's power and influence took a major leap during Nicholas II's papacy, which lasted between 1059 and 1061. He had always been on visiting terms with Matilda's family back in Tuscany, often stopping in Florence or even Mantua, Matilda's hometown, on his way to either France or Germany, but he and Duke Godfrey were somewhat partners now, having worked to elevate the Bishop of Florence to the papacy. Also, Matilda was entering womanhood. She was still very young at the time, but she was entering womanhood by this time. And to say that there wasn't an attraction forming would be naive, despite our modern sensibilities on things like age. So, Tuscany was in Hildebrand's back pocket now, so to speak. But, most importantly, what Hildebrand had been orchestrating over the previous years, well, that could finally be rolled out. If it hasn't been clear yet, let me state precisely where Hildebrand stood on the German crown meddling in papal affairs. Hildebrand loathed it. If you think it was Stephen who caused bishops in Rome to mostly stay in Rome, you'd be wrong. If you think it was Stephen who formalized the term cardinal to distinguish between certain levels of the clergy, then you'd be wrong again. And now, under Nicholas II, though he gets the credit for it as it was his papal bull that decreed it, if you think the creation of the College of Cardinals that elects popes even to this day, if you think that was Nicholas's idea, then you'd also be incorrect. All of this, every piece of it, had Hildebrand's name written all over it. Throughout the 1050s, Hildebrand had been maneuvering these pieces to slowly set up a situation where the infrastructure of bishops choosing their own pope would be there already by the time he made the move to completely kick the German crown out of the entire decision, out of Rome, you could say. At the Lenten Synod in Rome in 1059, Spike tells us, quote, "In March, when the Italian, French, German, and Spanish bishops convened in Rome, they were met with a four-point program that shook the church from top to bottom. A new papal election decree, drafted by Hildebrand, explicitly forbade any future interference by Roman nobles and German kings. The selection of popes was to be reserved to a select group of cardinal bishops, a pre-selected group of Benedictine monks." End quote. Now, that's what I've been calling the creation of the College of Cardinals, and it did effectively cut out the German crown from the choosing of a new pope. In fact, it was so effective that King Henry IV of Germany, of course, by proxy of his mother, Queen Regent Agnes, in a few short years, though, would prop up the opponent to future Pope Alexander II. His name would be Honorius II. He would be known forever as an antipope for the 11 long years he claimed the papacy until his death, and he would be the very last, I repeat, Honorius II would be the very last German-backed pope in history. Pope Nicholas II may have signed the papal bull creating the College of Cardinals, but the College of Cardinals was Hildebrand's brainchild through and through. Now, in addition to the election reform for new popes, the Lenten Synod was also known for a few other things that Hildebrand will continue to champion in the future as well. Nicholas II signed the papal bull declaring mandatory celibacy for all clergy. That was a biggie, as a great many priests and bishops and whatnot all had not only wives at the time, but also mistresses too. Many of them, even children. Very, very different than what we know today, wasn't it? Also, the practice of selling church offices, called simony, was also abolished. Boy, this one will make some waves in the future. So, most notably, by the way, between King William II Rufus in England and the same St. Anselm of Canterbury in the 1090s. Yeah, hold on to the idea of simony. In fact, Hildebrand stood by and watched in the late 1040s while Benedict IX became the first and only pope who literally sold the papacy for personal financial gain. Yeah, that happened. And to reformers like Leo IX and Hildebrand, among many, many, many others, this was an absolute abomination. You can't sell church offices. And finally, the fourth point of those 4 points at the Lenten Synod of 1059, the fourth point centered around what Hildebrand is probably most remembered for, the issue of investiture. Investiture is the practice of kings and other nobles choosing and installing their clergy, as Spike calls, quote-unquote, handing out bishoprics. We've seen this happen numerous times in the podcast already, and it occurred all over Christendom. This was now also outlawed. So that was a ton. Let's recap. 1, kings were no longer allowed to choose a pope. 2, priests were forced to practice celibacy. 3, selling church offices in general for anyone was now forbidden. And 4, kings and noblemen were no longer allowed to place their pawns into positions of ecclesiastic power. What we have seen here at the Lenten Synod of 1059 was a complete and utterly devastating victory over all of Christendom by the fanatic Cluniac reformers. Even Spike says, quote, "The Cluniac reformers' triumph was complete. Everyone else was shocked," end quote. Between marching with the Normans, marching against an antipope, receiving the brand new title of archdeacon in charge of the church finances, and orchestrating from the shadows major, like seismically big reforms that he once shared and developed with his friend Leo IX. All in the span of around 7 months, Hildebrand in 1059 was on an absolute tear. And in June of that same year, we see him accompany Nicholas II and what John Julius Norwich, in his book Absolute Monarchs, A History of the Papacy, what Norwich describes as, quote, an impressive retinue of cardinals, bishops, and clergy, end quote, which were on their way to the city of Melfi in Apulia. Oh, sorry, I missed a key detail there. Quote, the Norman city of Melfi in Apulia, end quote. To pull together some things we've already seen on the show, this was the moment that Richard of Capua was given the title of Duke of Aversa, and Robert Guiscard was given the title of Duke of Apulia, Calabria, and of course, Sicily. This was the famous 1050 Synod of Melfi. But, see, that's just what we remember of this historically pivotal event. What it was originally set up to do, set up and designed by Hildebrand himself, make no mistake about that, was not to give out new titles or to solidify the Norman papal alliance, though that was certainly a nice big part of it. That's not what it was intended for. Rather, the 1059 Synod of Melfi was really meant to reiterate everything declared at the Lenten Synod earlier that year. You know, all those reforms is what was meant. It was a rehashing of that, as in a, hey, don't forget about these, we haven't forgotten. In fact, Nicholas II reread and spoke about each one of the new reforms at length, and even went so far as to actually defrock the Bishop of Trani due to his refusal to submit to one or more of these dictates. Yeah, he defrocked a guy in front of 100 of his fellow clergymen. But what do we all remember? The rise of the Normans in the south, that's what. Keep in mind, not everybody was happy about those Normans gaining such esteem in the area, but we've probably talked enough about that already. But we know that the Germans were especially perturbed by both of these synods. No, that's not right. Perturbed isn't actually the right word. It was more like hatred fueled by the passions of a thousand suns. I still think that falls short, but we'll go with that one. It was after the 1059 Synod of Melfi that wheels started churning all over Central Europe, really Germany. And by 1061, a coalition of sorts coalesced. Due to the Normans' new alliance with the papacy and the reforms that affected pretty much every German clergyman, well, Nicholas II was, says Norwich, quote-unquote, ostentatiously omitted from the intercessions and all the empirical chapels and churches, while a synod of German bishops went so far as to declare all Nicholas's acts null and void and to break off communion with him. You can't actually excommunicate a pope, I think, but I'll be damned if Germany didn't try to do that in 1061. However, curiously, there was zero reaction from Nicholas II, because before he knew about it, he too was dead. Upon Nicholas's death, Germany threw its hat into the ring with renewed vigor. They put up, as we know, Honorius II, and the Cluniacs threw Alexander II into the ring. To add to the context we already have, Michelle Spike, again in her book Tuscan Countess, writes, quote, the Cluniac monks, together with Hildebrand's Roman faction, elected a different man, the most radical of their number, Anselmo de Baggio, as Pope Alexander II. They could not have made a more offensive choice, end quote. Anselmo de Baggio had already been on an absolute tear himself against King Henry III years earlier, even going so far as to declare that any bishop, though this was pointedly aimed at German clergy, any priest that sold or bought church offices at any level, any priest who married or kept mistresses or fathered children, any priest who held multiple churches, all sacraments given out by these priests should be null and void. That's kind of a big statement to make if you're not even Pope yet. So, Anselmo de Baggio, now Alexander II. We know how all this played out by now, at least outside of the papacy, outside of Rome, right? Count Roger sends a couple camels to him. Giscard is friendly enough with Alexander. Duke William up north gets a papal banner to make all the Saxons in England either, you know, bend the knee or be dead. Clearly, Alexander was the Pope in the minds of everyone. And I mean everyone outside of Germany. From the Lenten Synod to the Melfi Synod, to all the church reforms, it would be naive to think that Henry IV of Germany was unaware of Hildebrand's string-pulling and all this, even as young as he was. Any animosity Henry had toward the church was really animosity aimed at Hildebrand. This little storyline will play out in wild fashion later, soon, as in sooner rather than later, but just keep these two opponents in mind as we continue. Even Norwich writes in Absolute Monarchs, quote, "It was plain that a showdown between church and empire was inevitable. It was not long in coming," end quote. So as I've said, or alluded to in the past, the 1060s were a tumultuous decade. Whether you're rooting for the Normans, or rooting for Hildebrand, or rooting for Muslims in Sicily, or rooting for Saxons across the island, or rooting against any one of these, the 1060s were quite the decade. What hasn't been mentioned on the podcast about the 1060s yet happened on March 31st, 1062. After a year of threatening Queen Agnes of Germany to use German soldiers to storm Rome and depose Alexander, they just had enough of her inaction. German bishops gathered for Easter festivities and they invited young Henry IV, probably 11 years old by now, or thereabouts, just a couple years before he would take the crown as his own. They invited the young man, Spike writes, quote, "to tour Bishop Anno of Cologne's new boat, extravagantly outfitted. As soon as the lad stepped on board, the plank was raised and Henry was abducted down the river from Utrecht to Cologne," end quote. Queen Agnes was powerless to stop it, and she fled the scene. Now, Spike tells us that the bishops felt pretty guilty for stealing, you know, an 11-year-old boy king, so they spoiled the crap out of the kid, basically. They treated him like the king he soon would be by taking him out on hunts and giving him huge feasts. Spike even gives us the quite vomit-inducing details of priests offering the kid courtiers and other ladies of the night, shall we say? Spike writes, quote, "Years later, Henry IV recalled plaintively that after he was drawn away from the bosom of his mother, he did whatever the bishops prescribed, like the pliable boy he was," end quote. I don't know about you, but I really don't want to know what he was prescribed to do by those priests. Maybe that's just me. But at the end of it all, Henry IV was soon returned to his mother, but the message itself was clearly conveyed. Within 1 month, Agnes ordered Honorius II to be escorted into Rome as a direct opposition to Alexander II. It was time to move. Well, every action has an equal and opposite reaction, as we know. And with his links firmly established in the papacy, Duke Godfrey of Tuscany opposed the German army, surprisingly sending them back north. Now, we're going to switch gears just for a moment and talk about a monk named Peter Damian. And if I can ever find the time, and please tell me what the interest level is in something like this, Peter Damian will play a key role in at least one of a series of episodes laying out the philosophy and theology of the time. Again, I'd love to know if that interests you, so don't be shy. Please let me know. But Peter Damian was a hermetic monk who was not a big fan at all of Alexander II, and he made his case well known to any and all who would listen. The guy was a prolific letter writer, by the way, and we have many of those still today. And if you don't like Alexander II, then it's no secret that you probably despised Archdeacon Hildebrand even more. Spike tells us that around the year 1064, 1 year before Henry IV would reach majority up in Germany, mind you, that he had become quite sickened by the maneuvering and the subterfuge and the quarreling over the holiest positions in all of Latin Christendom. Spike writes, quote, "As usual, the most vehement and incisive spokesman was Pierre Damiani, Peter Damian, who was appalled at the cynical haggling over the price of St. Peter's throne. Hildebrand, the consummate power broker, bore the brunt of Damiani's ire. In a letter announcing his retirement in protest from Rome, Damiani called Hildebrand, quote-unquote, my flattering tyrant, before concluding in utter exasperation, quote, if I ought to die for writing this letter, here is my neck, you may strike it. Nevertheless, I humbly demand to my holy Satan not to act so cruelly against me, or let your venerable arrogance be so pitiless toward me, and that you employ some benevolence regarding your humble servant. My shoulders are already laden at their limit, and my back bent by blows." End both quote by Peter Damian as well as Michelle Spike. Even Norwich mentioned Damian calling Hildebrand, quote, my holy Satan. It is a long-forgotten attack on a fellow clergyman within Latin Christendom, but it's one that still strikes hard, and it still strikes pretty deep today. Clearly, as we've seen here, there is a very real difference between having power and having support. Hildebrand seemed to be leaning toward one of those over the other. Peter Damian would not see Hildebrand rise even higher. Peter Damian would die in 1072. But Spike reminds us that, quote, what little we know about the contemporary view of Hildebrand is summed up by Damiani's astonishing description, holy Satan, end quote. Let's switch gears just a little bit more, just so we can follow our other character in this episode. It's not that she's less important. I would vehemently argue against that. It's just that she was so young and she's just now entering adulthood, so we're learning more and more about her in the records. That's why there's just not been enough. But these two storylines, that of Hildebrand and that of Matilda of Canossa, I do want us to keep them kind of working together in the timeline from now on. In 1064, when Henry IV was kidnapped and spoiled by the German bishops, Matilda turned 16 years old. Her sweet 16. Well, not so sweet, I suppose, since her betrothal to her, get this, stepfather's son, a kid nicknamed the Hunchback. That betrothal was still on. But there's more to it. It's not just, well, the obvious issues with her situation. According to her own testimony, she was acutely aware that the moment she married the Hunchback, she would be forfeiting her rights to every single cent, an inch of land, and valuable of inheritance given to her by her beloved father, Duke Bonifacio. She put this marriage off as long as she possibly could, praying that things would change. Shockingly, she was able to hold off, stubbornly to the nth degree, no doubt, which is a testament to her personality. She was able to hold off until she was 21 years old. And that's just crazy. But as her stepfather was dying, that is Godfrey of Tuscany, was dying in 1069, the Duke and Matilda's mother Beatrice forced Matilda north, over the mighty Alps, and into Boulogne. From here, the Duke reconsecrated a monastery, his wife, Matilda, and the Hunchback were all present, and just before he died in his castle in Verdun, he saw that Matilda was married to his son, Godfrey III, that's right, nicknamed the Hunchback. Spike sums up Godfrey III's situation, besides being nicknamed, yeah, I'll say it again, the Hunchback. She says, quote, he was not devoid of qualities, but was now married to a beautiful, headstrong, cultivated, and supremely intelligent woman who loathed his very existence, end quote. That's a tough place for a guy to be in. Now, to be fair, I've made this unfortunate nickname out to be a punchline so far because that's how the casual reader would first encounter it. However, and by the way, and I think that's how Matilda herself in her own annals, her own chronicles, how she wanted it to come across. I think she wanted it to be a punchline. She truly loathed the man, right? However, there are monks' own writings saying that it was a congenital defect, something he absolutely couldn't change. But these writings, Spike tells us, didn't stop him from being a physically strong and capable man. Other descriptors of Godfrey III were wise, mature, and eloquent. Spike herself adds, quote, his soldiers respected him, a notable quality in those times, end quote. And then she adds, quote, all indications are that Matilda found her husband misshapen and repellent, end quote. And what's more is that Matilda's own priest, another guy named Anselmo, wrote that, says Spike, quote, Matilda's experiences in the marital bed, and this is Anselmo's words, horrified and revolted her, end quote. So I suppose that proves that the abuse against the opposite sex certainly went both ways, even 1,000 years ago. Just going to leave that one there. I'm sorry, I feel kind of bad for Godfrey. It's just me. But come on, it's still kind of funny, though. I mean, if you think about it, 1,000 years later, there's a Monty Python skit in there somewhere. Her in the marital bed and all that. There's got to be a funny skit in there somewhere. Now, on a serious note, it seems that in 1071, Matilda gave birth to a son. Sadly, a son that didn't make it. I can't imagine the heartbreak despite what she thought of her husband's appearance. This was recorded on May 9th of that same year. By December, just 2 years living with her new husband in his Duchy of Lorraine, she left for Tuscany. But she left without her husband. Yeah, she just up and left him behind. Now think about how unheard of that kind of thing was. She didn't like her situation, so she left. Though I feel bad for the guy, I have to admire somebody who takes his or her future by the horns. On January 19th of 1072, she reached her hometown of Mantua in Tuscany. Beatrice was already there. The reluctant bride had made her choice. After numerous entreaties by Godfrey to have his wife return to him in the north, she never returned to the north. To boot, she couldn't secure a divorce either. He even came to her in September of 1072. Spike calls it, quote unquote, a last ditch attempt by this seemingly decent man to save his marriage. Now, it's worth reminding ourselves that Godfrey III was his father's heir, so he was not only the Duke of Lorraine, but also the Duke of Tuscany. And whenever he held court there, Matilda was not there, her absence being a pointed exclamation mark on how she felt about that whole marriage. In February of 1073, Duke Godfrey left. To his credit, he was unlike a very large number of men who would have just detained his wife and forced her home. But he didn't do that, and she never again returned to Lorraine. So at last, having some crucial background information for what comes next, background information that clearly outlines the details of Archdeacon Hildebrand and Matilda of Canossa, we arrive where we left off at the end of the last episode. As we know, Robert Guiscard, Duke of Apulia, Calabria, and Sicily, lay dying in the Adriatic city of Bari in Apulia. His wife, the indomitable Sicilgeita, gathered all Norman barons throughout the duchies together, and they bypassed Robert's firstborn, nicknamed Bohemond, in favor of Sicilgeita's firstborn son, Roger Borsa, as Robert's one true heir. Word of this reached Rome in late April, implying the Duke's death. However, Rome was mourning again the death of their longtime Pope, Alexander II, who succumbed to sickness and old age, to be clear. He was in his 60s by 1073. This occurred, of course, on April 21st. The powerhouse Pope and the powerhouse Duke, both dead in April of 1073. It was a really tough pill to swallow. It wouldn't be until May 25th that a new pope would officially take the reins. That left the church in a bit of a pickle. Not one they weren't prepared for, mind you. Remember, since Nicholas II, the College of Cardinals were in charge of electing new popes, so there was a process upon which they could lean. In the meantime, leadership looked to one man to fill the void until a replacement could be dutifully elected. You guessed it. Archdeacon Hildebrand was that man. Now, beyond just planning and orchestrating the pomp and circumstance of Alexander's funeral and the banquets that accompanied it, as well as the convening of the cardinals in Rome to the Lateran Palace to begin the deliberations for a new pope, Hildebrand was the person who received the news that Duke Robert Guiscard had died. He had a lot to think about in that moment. Southern Italy and Sicily was just beginning to take full shape, and it was on friendly enough terms with the papacy. What would the future hold without its stodgy yet steadfast leader? Would this Roger de Hauteville claim it all, despite his nephew's election to the Duke? I mean, isn't that how Robert Guiscard himself took the reins? He just bypassed his nephew and took all the power for himself? If not, how would this young Roger Borsa take to the alliance with the papacy? Speaking of Roger Borsa, he's young. So how moldable was this kid? Could Hildebrand dig his talons in early and manipulate the situation to suit the papacy even further? See? Lots to think about. But first things first, Hildebrand had to ensure that the papacy stay on good terms with them. And offering support and a kind word in these times would be the best start, right? We actually have Hildebrand's own words in a letter back to Sigilgeita upon hearing of her husband's untimely death. In Hildebrand's own words, quote, "The death of Duke Robert, that dearest son of the Holy Roman Church, has left the church in deep and irremediable sorrow. The cardinals and all the Roman Senate do greatly grieve at his death, seeing themselves thereby brought low. But in order that your grace should know of our good will and of the perfect love which we bore your husband, we now request you to inform your son that it is the pleasure of the Holy Church that he should receive at her hands all those things which his father held from the Pope, our predecessor." End quote. Well, that was nice, wasn't it? It actually sounded sincere, and it sounded profoundly sympathetic, something a local priest would have offered to one of his beloved parishioners. But, as Norwich writes in Absolute Monarchs, quote, "it was, by any standards, a profoundly hypocritical letter. Hildebrand had no cause to love Robert. The Duke had not lifted a finger to help the papacy in its recent tribulations, while his brother Geoffrey de Hauteville and Geoffrey's own son, Robert of Loreteo, were even now ravaging valuable church lands in the Abruzzi." End quote. Oh, yeah, so there's that too. You know, Normans being Normans, shocker. But again, Hildebrand, well aware of all that, still needed to appeal kindly to the young Roger Borsa, and possibly more importantly, his mother, Sigilgeita, who wore her own proud and pugnacious reputation around southern Italy. All this was well and good. It was a smart political move on Hildebrand's part, hypocritical though it was. But the real surprise came when Hildebrand received a personal letter back just 2 weeks later. And by the way, a lot had happened, and we'll get to that in the next episode. A lot had happened in those 2 weeks, by the way. But the letter wasn't from Roger Borsa. It also wasn't from Sigilgeita, thanking the archdeacon for his kind words, support, and official investments to her son. The letter began with very kind words in return. A deeply thoughtful thank you for the words given to Sigilgeita and her children in the wake of the Duke's passing. But the letter held its surprise the further down you read. Robert Guiscard was not dead after all. In fact, the letter itself was sent from Robert, the old fox. Reports of his death, though seemingly imminent for a spell, were unfounded and without truth. These reports, though understandable at the time, the letter said, had simply jumped the gun. And in my own estimation, it was less that Robert had merely survived a horrific illness, and more that Robert Guiscard had simply refused to die. And you thought you were done with Guiscard. On the next episode, we pick up with the stories of Hildebrand, Robert Guiscard, and Matilda of Canossa as we enter the next big phase leading to the First Crusade. And I can't wait to tell you about it.